26 minutes to 9 o'clock on a Wednesday morning. It's a warm welcome to Gavin Steinhobel, back from the freeze. Last week you were leaving for an adventure which looked remarkable, but also looked remarkably like you were in the Alps. It was completely white roads.
I know, complete winter wonderland, which is what we were hoping for. But you've got to be careful what you wish for, because there was a lot more snow than what we anticipated.
What's it like riding in snow?
The snow itself is fun. It's not, obviously hasn't got the same traction as a dry gravel road, but you don't do long stretches of it. It's normally just as you go over passes and so on. And you don't follow the chap in front of you, because he squashes the snow and kind of creates like an icy sort of surface, so you sort of don't track each other. We'll just watch out for black ice, because there's really nothing you can do about that. You are going down. So, yeah, it's...
Did you find any?
Yeah, well, here and there, but you can kind of see it. And then also, like, you know, when we were on tar roads as well, you kind of got to be a bit ginger when you approach a wet spot on the road, because it might actually be frozen solid. So, it was interesting. We were meant to go up Nordea's Neck and across to Rhodes, and we were at the foot of the... And I was tour leader, and I sort of rallied the troops and got the trip going. And embarrassingly for me, when we got to the bottom of Nordea's Neck, there was a lady coming down in her 4x4, and she was obviously one of the local farmers' wives, and she'd gone to give the farmer some sandwiches, because he was on a bulldozer trying to clear the pass. And she said, "Where do you chaps think you're going?" And we said, "We're off up Nordea's and down to Rhodes." She said, "Have you not heard that the Tenorhead Lodge has been snowed under for 3 days? All the guests are stuck there, nobody can come and go." So, we had to turn around and go back to McClear, Yugi, Elliot.
So they were actually snowed in?
Yeah, there was about... The drifts were apparently as deep as 3 meters. So,
wow.
Yeah, so it was... So we had a change, very late afternoon change of plans, and eventually we were going up Barkley Pass, and I got the cohort to the side of the road, and I said, "Look, you know, here's the road. It's just starting to get dark. Off to the roads area. It's basically a two-spur to start out with, and it was full of snow and mud, and it just looked uninviting. Or we can go a bit further down the road, another 60 k's onto Barkley East, and from there there's a slightly better road and a slightly shorter way into the farm that we were staying at. And if you look over my shoulder, you'll see the Mountain Shadows Hotel, which is my vote." And there was no argument on that. We booked into the hotel sort of impromptu, and it was quite interesting. I remember reading an article about 2 years ago about a chap who had come a cropper with his mates on Buster Futsland Pot, which is the pass that Adam Tuss and his coloured a bunch of people, when they were fleeing the causes, they went up this mountain towards Lesotho, and it's called the Buster Futsland Pot, and it's a quite a notorious pass. And this guy coming down, obviously he had an off, injured himself. I think the bike fell on him, and he was had to be rescued. And the chap who rescued him was the then owner of the Mountain Shadows Hotel, and he was waiting to be taken to hospital at the hotel. And he said, "Well, it's quite a nice hotel." And the chap says, "Well, it's for sale." So he went and got better, came back and bought the hotel, obviously under the promise that it was a self-running thing and he could continue living in the Cape. But he realized pretty quickly that he's got to get there and drive this thing. And so it was quite an interesting story. So all those people there's a picture I put on Facebook of Donne Nordea, who's the chap who was with the bulldozer trying to clear Nordea's neck.
I saw that picture. Yeah, on that tractor.
Yeah, and so Donne's grandfather was one of the Nordeas that built that very pass.
How marvelous, being that sort of heritage.
I know, it's just remarkable. And, his brother Stefan was coming from the other side, because they own all the land over the pass, was coming from the other side trying to clear it from that end. And hopefully, they met each other a few days ago, I think, and cleared the pass. But those intrepid people, I mean, the grandparents or the grandfather of Stefan and Donne Nordea, they petitioned the Eastern Cape government, or the Cape government then, as it was, and they said, "We need to get a pass to go up onto the escarpment here, because there's lovely summer grazing up there, and open up that whole part of the country." And the government wrote back and said, look, you know, we've done the calculations. It's going to cost about £120,000. It's way too much money, and there doesn't seem to be much purpose. And as intrepid Afrikaans farmers do, they said, well, you know, give me a team of labor, and I'll do it myself.
Wow.
And so they got a scar, and the two Nordea brothers at the time, and they built this pass, which is still the pass today, and they actually maintain it themselves. And so, you know, it's a rugged and rough pass, but it's well constructed, and it's never washed away or fallen down.
Is it doable in a 4x4?
Yes, it's wonderful. I mean, it's really a beautiful part of the world. I mean, for anybody who wants to really get out there, you know, it's a World Heritage Site, that entire roads area, because it's still got grasslands that are protected and look exactly like they must have done 1,000 years ago. So there's no real forestry, and the farming is grazing farming, and so yeah, it's pretty untouched. It's beautiful vistas from up there, and obviously if you're up there when it's snowed, it's just spectacular, as you could see from the photos. So,
wow, well, yeah. you have come back clearly revitalized,
yeah,
and ready to take on the approach of winter in Ballito, which is nothing like you've just been through.
So no.
You went through like the Wim Hof approach to ice bath.
Well, we were cold to start out with, but after all the battles and struggles and getting your bike through everything, you know, we were quite warm. So well, yeah.
And now, you know, getting swinging.
And also, I think you know why one of the things that energized me on, you know, is you just spend 5 days totally offline.
Ah.
So you're not, you know, there's no looking at your phone every 5 minutes, and
there's no
phone calls, and no, you know, it was just, you know, 5 days in your helmet with your own mind, and it was, it's interesting stuff, and it's, I think we forget how little time we actually spend with ourselves these days, you know.
It is one of the maladies of the 21st century, for sure.
And we're going to probably find out that there's some, obviously, like everything that you overdo, there's going to be some repercussions for mental health and physical health. And
I think it's already evident. You know, the average attention span is that of a gnat. You can't, if you write a long-ish piece, it's not going to be read by almost anybody.
Yeah.
Put a few pictures and captions, and you know, that's
the
article.
Woman famously said on the American news, I ain't got time for that.
Well, you know, we swing the conversation now to matters international and national. And there's, while you were away, the world changed again. And,
yeah.
And you know, the things kind of escalated now to the point where Donald Trump is considering a U.S. strike on Tehran following the situation room crisis talk. Now, apparently, and I was listening to that extraordinary billionaire now entering into politics, very sort of center-rightist, very capitalist, and outspoken about almost everything. And a lot of people find him interesting, a lot of people find him irritating. But Rob Herzog certainly is not shy to put it like he sees it. And he was saying that he'd been listening to Iraj Abedian, who's an economist, talking about Iran, because he comes from there, and he knows a lot about the situation, clearly. And he found it extraordinarily insightful. And his takeaway from this entire situation is that America now must act. And it sounds like, what are you talking about? That could precipitate the Third World War. And he says, well, it's the only opportunity, really, to nip this thing in the bud before it becomes a real cataclysm.
I think, like all things, you know, they get to a point through sheer political neglect. And, you know, historically, they put pretty tough sanctions on the Iranians because they are a pariah of the East, and they are hugely destabilizing, and they do sponsor a lot of terrorism. And so they were sanctioned properly, and they were back in the box, in a sense. And the Biden administration decided, as a gesture of goodwill, to release all their assets that had been under sanctions, had been confiscated, and they released them to them, billions of dollars, and to free up a little bit the sanctions regime. What Iran did with that money is immediately sponsor the terror groups, Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, and assorted other players in Syria, and they have as their, you know, this is an existential thing, and that is that they have as their number one goal the annihilation of the state of Israel. Okay, as their number two goal is the complete and total subjugation of women in their society. So you know, this is a theocracy, and it's based on theocratically with huge antipathy for the Jews and the desire for their annihilation. And they've said it time and time again: Israel's a small Satan, America's the big Satan. They're coming for both. And you know, this is just in this day and age, that's belligerent stuff. And the Israelis, the Jews, having previously suffered a Holocaust, are looking at this country that says, we're sworn to annihilate you, and not only that, we are busy preparing nuclear weapons. Mm. And if we get the bomb, there's no doubt in anybody's mind where that bomb is going. So we can't in our lifetime have another Holocaust of the Jewish people. And, so I think everybody, almost every right-minded person, is going, well, this has to be put to a stop. Now, Donald Trump started speaking to the mullahs, and he said, I'm going to give you 60 days to make a deal. Many deals have been made with them. They've never stuck to them. You know, the Atomic Commission said that they are completely delinquent when it comes to reporting or telling them what they're doing. They sort of, in the fashion that they always have, they try to delay this these talks to win time, and perhaps beat the deadline to get a bomb, because once you've got a bomb, everybody treats you differently. So the Israelis obviously looked at this and weighed up the odds and said, well, we'll wait for Donald Trump's 60 days to expire. And on day 61, they attacked Iran. And Iran turned out to be a hell of a lot weaker than the posturing proposed. And it seems to be a pretty much a one-way street. I must say that it does appear to me that when the Americans said they were going to meet on Sunday with the Iranians for further talks, that was a bit of a ruse, because the Iranians then thought, well, we're fine, and they weren't prepared for what came. Mm. So, should they have a nuclear weapon? No, not with their politics, and certainly not with their intent. I mean, that'll be the end of millions of people. So, this nuclear thing is quite an interesting thing, because, the Ukrainians gave up their nuclear arms as well at the end of the Soviet Union. They were coerced by all the other countries, saying, look, if you're going to be a country on your own, you shouldn't have nukes. And the Ukrainians agreed to it. And they agreed to it on condition that their security be guaranteed by America, Britain, France, and Russia. And, Russia's invaded them since. Very interesting what's come out of all of this is, the Iranians were allies, obviously, of the Chinese and the Russians, and none of them have come to their aid. And won't.
Interestingly, Russia has condemned, or the foreign ministry has condemned, Israel's attacks on Iran, calling them illegal. Yes. I mean, is that not ironic?
The pot calling the kettle black.
It's a wonderful world we live in.
Yeah. It's interesting for me on this basis, and that is that one has always felt that there's something coming, and one has always been highly concerned that it'll draw into the fray enough countries to almost be like a world war. And it's quite clear that this is not going to happen. And I think it's important just for the Middle East, because I think everything takes time. But the Middle East in general, are seeming to turn, more towards Western models, Western ways of doing business, and opening up, looking for peaceful ways of modus vivendi, as they say, of living together. And so I think this is just one of the bricks that has to topple for the Middle East to become a far safer and peaceful place.
Yeah, that kind of coincides pretty much with the message that our friend Herzog was putting out. Apparently, the reason that America needs to get involved to finish this thing is because there is a very strong indication that there in a bunker
Fordow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the Israeli munitions that they have are not able to penetrate that bunker, but America has got a bunker busting mechanism of epic proportion.
Well, there's a lot of opinion that that America probably won't need to, because the Israelis will probably reach a point where they can simply drive there and detonate the place. So I think Americans are just watching, and there's sort of like an insurance policy if that isn't possible in time. But it's very interesting. I think when things have changed, you know, in the Middle East, and hopefully they've changed for good. You know, the terrorist groups have all one by one been bowled over, and I think even the majority of Arab countries, you know, they don't really want war. They've realized prosperity is the way, and that's how people have better lives. So also, you know, the world thing's not going to go on forever either. So, you know, one will have to fit into the world. So it's interesting. Nobody wants any of this. But, you know, sometimes if you want to continue a civilized existence, you have to defend it. And
yeah, that's pretty evident from all aspects of examination.
And we got to this point purely because of the fact that the original treaties and stuff that were signed were never enforced, because there was a sort of a kicking the football into the future by the political people of the day, you know, especially the Democrats in America. So, you know, we've got to a point. I think it's going to reach a logical conclusion, and I think there'll probably be regime change in Iran. You know, the prince, you know, the Shah of Iran's son, he's standing by. He claims that within Iran they do have a plan. You know, one must remember also that the Iranians are not Arabs. They're Persians, and, you know, they were Zoroastrians originally, and they're not originally Islamic at all. So it's strange how they've completely been run over by the theocracy. I know that statistically, when they've done, which is hard to do, but when they've done sort of on the ground tested people, I mean, less than 10% believe that their government is what they want. You know, and by their own polling, their government's polling 15% of people.
Oh, wow.
You know, so very few Iranians actually agree with what's going on, firstly. That's why Israel's very cautious to always say we're not fighting the Iranian people, we're fighting the Ayatollahs. And then, you know, the Iranian, there was a huge diaspora where you know, intellectuals and so on were chased out of Iran. Those people are all watching with interest. It's been a long time. Whether they, you know, will go back or not, I doubt. But, you know, they've got people they can draw on. So it'll be interesting, because Iran was quite a spectacular place back in the day. I don't know if you've seen those old photos of girls running around in, you know, in mini skirts and going to university and doing all the things that Western ladies do.
It was very, very progressive.
And then to become sort of, you know, where somebody wears their shawl incorrectly and they get murdered by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. You know, that created an outcry as well at the time. So I think there's people with the shackle of an autocratic system on them, and I think they want to be free, like all people.
An interesting perspective, as always. Very well put, Gavin. I have to draw a conclusion there, because time is against us yet again. But look forward to extending the invitation for another chat in a week's time.
Yeah, I'll be here.
I look forward to that hugely. Okay. Gavin Steinhobel, attorney at law from Kloppers Inc. And if you need a good attorney, you'll find him down in the Balito Village. And he will be back on Wednesday next. But if you have joined us late and you wanted to get the full gist of this conversation, it'll be up as a podcast shortly. Thanks, Gavin. We'll see you in a week's time.
Thank you, Dad.
And the morning show continues.